Welcome to App Fabric TV. I'm your host, Ron Jacobs, joined today by Howard
Durking.
How do I say
Durking? Yeah, Durking.
I never say your last name, so I just, you know. Anyway, Howard's across the hall from me, and I don't say his last name. What is up with that? Anyway, I just say, hey, Howard, when I need something, right?
It's because my alias is Howard.
Yeah, that's so weird, too. Yeah, how did you get that? Anyway, all right, so you're on the WCF team, and you've been working with the new WCF Web API thing, which I think we're going to have a different name for that eventually. I don't know. Anyway, that's
what
it is.
Web API isn't specific enough?
It's kind of all-encompassing, isn't it?
Yeah. If you're doing anything on the web, you should do Web API.
Yeah, that's right. There you go. All right, so today I've asked you to come on the show and show us some of this stuff. Glenn has been here, Glenn Block, showed us a few things.
My partner in crime.
Yeah, that's right. So why don't you show us what you've got going here?
Yeah, so what I'm going to show today is actually taking advantage of something that, one of the specific things that we've done in Web API, specifically down in the channel layer. You've probably written a WCF channel before, right?
Yeah, way back in the day.
You recovered? It was.
Yeah, I tried to forget it. Yeah. You know, it was traumatic.
Most people do, yeah. So the big idea is that, you know, in WCF, writing a channel is really a pretty painful experience, and it requires you to know quite a bit about how WCF works internally.
Right.
And in Web API, one of the goals that I'm sure Glenn has spoken to that we tried to do was really simplify the extensibility points.
Right.
And we basically condensed it down to just a handful. So we've got a plugin point in the service model layer, right? Mm-hmm. So where you can deal with the actual operation parameters and the operation description and all of those sorts of things, but still in an HTTP way.
Right.
And then what I'm going to talk about today is that we've actually introduced an extensibility point in the channel layer, which doesn't require you to deal with all of the baggage of the channel layer, but actually enables you to deal with WCF messages, but at that low level.
Okay.
So the scenario is, and I think this is a pretty common one, is e-tags. So,
okay, so let's define e-tags for people who don't know e-tags. All right, shoot, what's an e-tag?
let's start with the problems that e-tags solve. Right?
Okay.
And there's two, and actually I talked about this in context of WCF 4 in my tech ed presentation, which I think is online these days. So, but to give you the synopsis, one of the great things about HTTP is that it has these semantics to enable caching, right? Caching is a great, great thing. The problem is that when you cache a lot of stuff, you introduce the reality that there is stale data that people can be working on.
Right.
And so, like in any distributed system, there's a problem that comes up, and that is, well, when I update something, how do I know that I'm updating the most recent thing or that it hasn't been updated by someone else? You know, the buzzword, of course, being optimistic concurrency.
Right, right.
And
okay.
So e-tags, so HTTP has two additional things which enable you to manage the natural tension between the ability to cache and the ability to control concurrency.
Okay.
Those two things are the last modified header. The other one is e-tags. So there's kind of the natural question there is, well, why are there two things and when would I use one over the other?
Right.
In general, e-tags is kind of the becoming, I guess, the more popular method. But the reason is actually pretty simple. It's because when you use last modified, you can only go down to the second. And so if you have things that are changing more frequently than 1 second, you need a different mechanism than last modified.
Yeah, in fact, any kind of time-based tag would be subject to this sort of race condition, right?
Okay. So the key thing with e-tags, you know, a lot of times when people see them, the immediate concern is, well, how do I generate these things? And, you know, what does it mean?
Okay, so we should, just before we dive into that, though, we should say what it actually
that's right.
is.
What does it look like? So let's see if I've got Fiddler up here. I'm going to actually just run this thing that we're going to take a look at in a second. And let's actually see what an e-tag looks like. So I'm in Fiddler.
Okay.
And I'm going to go over to my request builder. And I'm just going to fire off a GET request to this sample service that I have.
Okay.
So localhost, port 10,000, and test resource. Did I spell that right? Resource. All right. So what does an e-tag look like? It comes back on the response, and it comes back with this header.
Ah, okay. So according to HTTP, this could be whatever you want it to be. I mean, it doesn't have to be any certain format or
and
whatever.
That's the
right?
key thing, right?
Right.
It doesn't have to be, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, well, I'll generate a hash of my object graph. And it's a pretty expensive way to go about it, and
right.
we're going to show an alternative today.
Okay.
The
uh-huh.
key thing is that an e-tag is just an opaque string. Your client should not ever try and infer any meaning from this string.
Right, right, okay.
And from a syntactic standpoint, one of the key things to note here is that it always needs to be in quotes. Right?
Okay.
That's a big deal, according to the HTTP spec.
Right, right. Okay, and so if I do an e-tag, then... So if I'm the browser, and you're the server, okay?
Okay.
So... I just made a request. I said, hey, server, will you give me this thing?
Right.
And you shot back this, and you said, here's this thing, and by the way, it has an e-tag, and here's the tag.
Yep. And what do you do with that?
As far as I know, I don't know what it's for or anything, but I just file it away and say, okay, I'm going to cache this thing, and I'm going to save that e-tag.
Yep.
Okay, good. All right, that's what it's for so far.
So here's the cool thing, right?
Uh-huh.
Your browser automatically knows what to do with e-tags.
At least
in a lot of browsing scenarios.
Okay.
So there's two, right?
Yeah.
One is, we talked about, how do we know whether I can cache it or whether I can still cache it.
Okay.
So caching, even, is mm-hmm. actually kind of two phases, right?
Right.
One is, I cache for an amount of time,
mm-hmm.
right? And when that expires, what happens, right? There's this second process, and this is where e-tags are involved, called revalidation.
Okay.
Right? And so what happens is, your browser can send what's called a conditional get...
Yeah.
back to the server, which is good, right? Because it doesn't have to send everything, right?
Yeah.
It just has to say get. In fact, you know what? Let's just do that, right?
All right.
So we're going to call the same resource, but we're going to add something. Let's go back and let's grab that e tag. Okay. And let's go back to this request builder and let's add something. It's because if none match. Now
beautiful.
I'll explain that in a second because
that's
a nicely confusing name, right? And we'll add our e-tag.
Okay.
So the way to think about this is if this e-tag does not match,
mm-hmm.
right? If none match, then process the get request.
Okay. Okay. So I'm the browser. I say, go ahead and I'm what I'm saying is I have one of these.
Yep.
It's
for
e-tag,
this resource.
Yeah. Its e-tag is this.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have one of those or when you calculate a tag for this thing, it's different.
Yep.
Right. Then send it.
Then process the get request.
Yeah.
If not, right, and because we haven't changed anything, then send a 304.
And 304 means not modified. That's
right. So not modified. And notice, the reason that this, even though I'm having to make a round trip back to the origin server, the reason that this is still an improvement is because I'm not sending anything in the body.
Right.
So imagine this was a fairly big request. I've actually saved quite a bit of bandwidth.
Right, right. Now, on the other hand, you did have to do whatever it is you did to calculate the e-tag in order to answer this.
That's right, that's right.
So it has to be fast.
It does have to be fast, and that's why what we're going to show here with this code, taking advantage of that low channel level insertion point, is really valuable.
Okay.
Because the reality is, this is an opaque string.
Yeah.
You don't have to know what the actual object graph is in order to manage these things.
Right, right.
All you have to know is there's a resource, mm-hmm. right? When I do a put or a post against that resource, I can reason that my e-tag is going to change.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And if it's a get request, then I can do a lookup into this, you know, table, you know, dictionary that I maintain, and I can make my decisions based on that, right?
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right. So cool. Let's go see.
So, what we're taking advantage of here is this, we're deriving our hand...
Yeah, I have to say, you've gone to the dark side here, haven't you?
I have, you know, I've stared at code long enough to where the white background, you know, makes my eyes pop out of my head.
Okay. All right, that's cool. It's cool. I like it, but all right, go ahead. Yeah.
So what we've got here is this message handler, right? That's
okay. That's
what we're calling it in Web API.
Mm-hmm.
And we're deriving from this thing called delegating channel, right? And so what we've got actually on the server is... You know, because it's called channel, and then there's a WCF channel, and it's like, which is which?
Yeah.
So what we've got is, we've gone to the pain of writing the WCF channel that's basically a container for all of these delegating channels.
Oh, okay.
And basically what happens is when the channel stack is built up, these things are put together in, you've heard the term Russian doll model.
Okay,
right? So
right.
This one, and then this one wraps this one, and this one wraps this one. And so we put that all together. And so you can see we've got this notion of an inner channel,
right?
The Russian doll.
Uh-huh.
And the cool thing here is the method that we're overriding here is this send async.
Okay.
So this is another really cool thing that we've got here, is that we're doing everything async. So if you have something that is I/O bound, or let's say it calls a service to make a decision for processing the response, that thread can be released back to WCF to keep processing requests, even though your request will have to wait. WCF doesn't have to
wait. And this will make Jeff Richter very happy.
Yes.
Okay.
Because really, one of our goals when we designed this was to make Jeff Richter happy.
Exactly. No, and I mean, the beautiful thing is I noticed that it uses task of T here.
And
it,
yes.
And because a lot of people were like, in the past, when they're going, oh, I have to implement something that returns an async result. Now I've got to go create this object, this whole big hairy thing. That was way hard. This is much easier.
And then try mapping that onto, okay, well, what about how do I get to the response? Or how do I short circuit this thing? Or how do I make it propagate back up?
Even
with tasks, it takes a little bit of getting used to. It took me a bit of getting used to.
Right.
So, you know, the big idea here is to continue or to allow the message to continue propagating through the model and then up into service model, you need to call the base.sendAsync.
Okay.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Which that has the effect of saying this.innerChannel.sendAsync. Right? That's
right.
What happens.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Cool.
To short circuit,
yeah.
Right? And to basically say, I'm done processing it, I'm going to return, which we're going to show when we want to do a 304, right?
Yeah.
When we do not modified, then you simply return your own task.
Oh, right? Okay.
To let it propagate up. And then to also process the response, you take advantage of something in the task world called a continuation.
Yeah, yeah. Beautiful.
I guess it's more general than the task world, but task uses continue with, so it's
right.
And so you send the continuation, it keeps on propagating, comes back down, and then hits your continuation, processes it, and it goes out the door.
Sweet. Okay.
So we've shown a little bit about e-tag processing. Let's take a look at how that's implemented. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to say if the method is get, right? Because that's where we're going to return a 304.
Okay.
So what we're going to say here is if it's not a conditional get, then we're going to allow it to continue processing, right? So we're going to do this base.sendAsync, and we're also going to continue with, right? So we're going to add that continuation. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to get, we're going to create an e-tag for it.
Ah, okay, right.
So if you send me a get, I don't have it in my e-tag store,
right,
then we're going to go ahead and add one, and we're going to send it on down. Now, for this example, our e-tag store is basically just an in-memory dictionary, right? So I've got a URI as my key, and I've got an e-tag as my value.
Okay.
My e-tag, I'm just generating a GUID. Because remember, I don't have to know anything about the object.
Right.
So a GUID is perfectly sufficient for these purposes.
Okay, and so being an in-memory store, it's suitable for a single server solution, right?
It's suitable for a demo.
right. And of course, this design assumes that nobody's updating things directly from the database side or something like that,
right?
Yeah, okay. Just had to throw that out
so
there.
So as you grow in your complexity of your system,
okay.
You probably want to grow the complexity of this, of this code.
But it's a good model. I mean, you could, whatever the e-tag store is, you need a thing that could figure out for any given URI, what its e-tag should be.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
So that's get, right? And so what we're going to do is if we get a get request, right, that doesn't have an e-tag, we're going to create one. We're going to send it back in the response.
And you know what I love, I just have to point out the object model here is very cool. I mean, so you can just say, you know, response headers e-tag. Very clean, right? Equals new entity header tag value. Boom.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, right?
Yeah.
So what we have here is we're taking advantage. A lot of people, you remember in the REST starter kit, there was the web HTTP client, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
We had web HTTP request message and HTTP response message. And that's actually baked in now on the server side, even in this low-level channel model.
Right.
So we're still dealing with HTTP response message and HTTP request message.
And yeah, so you have these objects that have a very clean object model right over it. So like when you said, oh, by the way, it has to have quotes on it, like in the old API world, you had to be sure to do that,
right?
But in this one, I assume the entity tag header value just does that for you.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. So you get good conformance with the HTTP spec without even really having to become an expert in it.
And the other interesting bit here is that this is symmetric, right?
Yeah.
So the same object model exists on the client as it does on the server.
Ah, sweet. Okay, cool.
Yes. So moving on down the line here. So we're saying if it's not modified, then, and again, this is where we're not going to keep propagating the message through.
Okay.
So if it's not modified, we want to stop processing the request, and we just want to return a 304.
Okay.
Right? So here, we're basically creating our new task, and that's just what we're returning. We're returning a new task factory, start new.
Start new. Uh-huh.
And we're basically going to set our new status code.
Uh-huh.
Right? We're going to go ahead and also send back our E tag.
Right. Okay.
And we're just going to kick it right back out.
Sweet.
All right. So, and then finally, if it has been updated,
okay,
right, then we're going to let it go back through because we want to do the full GET request. This is actually really similar to that first one,
right,
whereas an E tag didn't exist. So, and then on the continuation, we're going to get the new E tag value and send it on its way.
Okay. Right. Okay, cool.
So that's GET.
Right.
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 And that's
beautiful.
How we're managing conditional GETs.
Uh-huh.
Now, let's talk about updates, right?
Because
that gets a little interesting. So I'm going to jump back over to Fiddler here. And what we've said is when I update a request, right, I want to change the E tag value.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So just to sort of show what that looks like, I'm going to go ahead and change this to a put. And let's see here. Do string because we're using the XML serializer.
Okay.
And let's also make sure that we specify the content type. Now, if I were to just execute this by itself, it would blow up.
Oh, okay.
And the reason is
is
because we're not specifying our E tag.
Ah, okay.
Right?
So you're going to insist on an E tag.
I'm going
to
insist on an E tag with this.
Okay.
So the way you do that, just like we had if none match for a conditional get,
right?
There's if match for a conditional put. And the way to read that is, if this E tag matches, then execute the put.
Right, because that means that I have the latest copy.
That's
and
right.
I know I'm not overwriting somebody else's update.
That's exactly right. So we'll say if match, and let's go back and make sure that we have our E tag correct. And we'll just add that that first parenthesis back here. So let's see, application XML, I'm passing this. That should be good. Great.
Okay.
So
cool.
I get a 200 back.
Yep.
Now, one of the things I want you to notice is
that
E tag value should be changed in my response.
And it has, because
the previous one started with 4.
Right, right.
So now, this is where we get into that optimistic concurrency. Let's say I wanted to execute this exact same thing again.
Okay, yeah.
Now, 412.
412.
Oh, 412, what does that mean? So, and you know, unfortunately, the description is not that much more, helpful if you haven't looked at the HTTP spec.
Right, right.
Precondition failed. Okay.
Oh, what does that mean?
Are they using code contracts? I don't think HTTP is. But what that means is that basically you have an optimistic concurrency violation. That
right.
The state of the resource is not consistent with the E tag that represents the state of the representation that you sent to update.
Right, and in the HTTP spec, when you read it, it's like it says, it calls this a precondition, you know, for the update, check of the header.
Yep.
Right, yeah.
So what we need to do, so the basic workflow is, I'm doing these updates, I send it, I get a precondition failed, therefore, I want to do another get, right?
Yeah.
So I'll pull this back over to my request builder, and I'll execute another get so that I have the latest version of the E tag. And then I can execute my put again. Let me change the E tag value here. And then it works.
Yeah, so you just said, look, I don't care if somebody else updated it, I'm going to update it anyway.
That's right. But the idea
right.
is that you can at least get the latest representation to see whether that is going to be a good thing or a bad
thing. Yeah, yeah. I mean, you could do something like, look at their thing, what changed? Oh, so they changed something else.
That's
maybe
right.
I'm going to change this anyway. So.
That's right. And, I mean, that's really not that inconsistent with how the larger frameworks, like within the SQL realm,
sure,
enable
sure.
that.
And these are actually all the same. If these problems sound familiar, it's because they're all the same problems we had with databases and pushing updates through and optimistic concurrency there. You just use different mechanisms to do it. I mean, to detect if things have changed or not and all that kind of stuff.
And the cool thing, and this is certainly something that I was not aware of until I had joined the team, is that HTTP has provisions for all of these things baked right in. I mean, that have been baked right in for years, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, Henrik, who's
our architect,
was one of the contributors to the HTTP spec, so he knows it very well.
Very well, yes. Not only knows the spec, but can actually give you the history of how...
He can tell you about, you know, where they were sitting at the table in the room when they talked about it. You know, that sort of stuff.
It's invaluable having his experience on the team.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's see how this is implemented. It should look very similar to how we've been doing the GET request. So if we have a state-changing request, so you can see I actually have this for put and post,
mm-hmm.
right? We're going to let the request processing continue because mm-hmm. we obviously want to allow it if it matches.
Okay.
Right? So we're going to... go ahead and return the base.sendAsync.
Okay.
We're going to add the continuation, and we're going to then update the e-tag for this request URI.
Ooh, so, interesting. Okay,
e-tag store, update e-tag, mm-hmm. right? And then we're going to return the response.
So when you send the response, okay, so the inner channel is going to go through and do its thing. When mm-hmm. it finishes...
And by do its thing, it's going to basically pass the request up into your service.
Okay, right. And so continue with happens on the way out.
That's right.
Right, so then on the way out, you're going to add the new header.
That's right.
Okay. I get it. All right, good. Okay.
Okay. And then the converse is the same, right? So if we mm-hmm. want to do a 412, we want to mm-hmm. do a precondition failed, basically what we say is, you know, and this is basically saying if it didn't match, mm-hmm. right, then I want to not return the base.sendAsync.
Okay.
I'm going to return my own task,
uh-huh.
and I'm going to create this new response message with the status code of precondition failed, and I want to set the correct e-tag, just to be mm-hmm. helpful, because I like being helpful.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to set the proper e-tag on that response as well, uh-huh. and go ahead and send it out.
And if you wanted to, you could even put some other friendlier text there if you wanted to, right? You could?
You could. I mean, the HTTP, HTTP certainly has, these are pretty well understood.
Yeah, right.
But we do give you the flexibility to put whatever you want in there.
Okay, cool.
So that's the basic workings of this e-tag manager.
Sweet.
Now, mm-hmm. it is worth pointing out a couple things.
Mm-hmm.
One is my actual resource.
Yeah.
I'm not really doing much of anything.
Okay.
I haven't had to introduce a lot of, you know, any bleed of my e-tag stuff into my actual service.
Right.
The other bit is how this is being wired up. Uh-huh. If you looked at the config, there's really no config for this,
right.
which, again, from a WTF standpoint is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so what I'm actually doing here is I'm wiring this up in this add message handlers. So this is really the only thing that I'm having to do. Pass it the type of my mm-hmm. e-tag handler. And then down here, when I'm mapping my service route, mm-hmm. then I'm passing in my base address of my service, which is test resource, and my config class, which has this message handler added to it.
Okay.
Sweet. Now you can see, and we're not talking about this today, but one of the other things that I've done here that a lot of folks are probably excited about is I actually have a IOC container resolving my entire service graph.
Castle.windsor there.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
I know Glenn has MEF, and that's cool. But just to show a little diversity.
Well, it is worth pointing out that you guys as a team said dependency injection and IOC containers is something that we think our customers need.
Yeah.
And we want to give them the choice to use the thing they like. You're not going to say, you must use MEF or whatever. Right. We're going to say, use the one you want, and we'll show you. You can do any of them.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, basically what that amounts to is, and you know, just to show you a little bit, is I have this thing, this Windsor factory that derives from this interface.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you would expect, its job is to resolve instances. And that's really all that's happening here.
So that's cool. All right. So Now, if people are like, dang, that looks really cool, I want to check this out, I want to get this, where did they get it?
So wcf.codeplex.com.
Okay.
Preview 4, I think, was our latest drop.
Right.
And I basically built all of this straight from Codeplex.
Now, do you have this sample code somewhere?
It's not public right now. Uh-huh. There's no reason why it can't be public. I just haven't pushed it.
So I challenge you.
Expect very soon.
Make it public.
Yeah. We'll probably put this up. We're incrementally building with our advisors and in public this reference implementation called REST cart, basically a shopping cart implementation that uses a RESTful, actual REST, the constraints of REST. I'll probably push this up there in the REST cart.
Oh, okay.
Implementation.
Okay, sweet. So, all right, now we're going to do just a little bonus feature here at the end. Just a little. We were talking earlier, kind of on, I don't know if people are familiar with the term life hacking, but so there's a lot of stuff on the web about just kind of ways to have a good work style. And it's, as a Microsoft PM, you are extraordinarily busy. You get all kinds of things thrown at you. People want stuff. And it's very important to stay focused and organized on the right things at the right time. It's an incredible challenge.
One of the biggest.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's that way for a lot of people who are watching our show. I mean, everybody has stuff like this going on in their life. So you have a unique way for dealing with this. Why don't you show us what you've done?
So this past year, a friend of mine named Jeff Cox, who is in the MSDN team, wrote a Scrum application called Scrum Pig. And it's totally free, and so I said, I'll give this a shot.
Okay.
And the big idea here is that...
And you do this with a team of one.
I do, I do it for a team of one. Uh-huh. Although hopefully that will change over time. So the big idea is that, a lot of the Scrum software that's out there today is very, very feature-rich, but one of the trade-offs that you get when you get feature richness is you end up causing a lot of confusion about, what's just the core process, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't want to have my process be centered around a tool. I want the tool to, conform to my process.
Right.
And if you're like me, you want your process to be as simple as possible.
Yeah, and for those of us who are not Scrum masters and all this stuff, I know a little bit about it, but I'm certainly not an expert. So a lot of tools would be big learning curve. Right?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, especially when most people, consider Scrum to be this stand-up that ends up turning into the status update meeting. So what I liked about this tool was its simplicity, and then it kind of forced me to do some things that I had gotten a little bit undisciplined about doing. And I'll just show you real quick.
Show me.
So backlog and backlog wall, this is just the standard backlog, product backlog.
Mm-hmm.
And it does make the distinction between your product backlog and your sprint backlog, right?
Mm-hmm.
So your sprints, right? And actually, let's just go down from the top. So roster, just me.
Okay.
And you can see this committed hours thing. And we'll take a look at that in a second. Schedule, right? So this is when you plan the boundaries of a sprint.
Okay.
My personal sprints are 2 weeks.
Ah, okay.
So I set that up. And then you see the tasks, right? So these are all of the tasks that I've got planned for last week and this week. And as you can see, I still have quite a few things to do this week.
Okay.
And one of the things that this really forces you to do is put estimates. See, this is one of the areas where I had become a little bit undisciplined. And I was great at it when I was a dev, right? Because you have to.
Yeah.
But as a PM, I'd gotten out of the habit of estimating. And that seems really... why do I have to estimate? Well, you kind of see it show up in a second here.
Yeah.
But the idea here is you provide an estimate in hours, and then you can actually see how you're tracking, against what you've committed and what you've estimated what you've done, right? So the question then is, well, where are you committing? This is where the estimation part was really helpful to me.
Yeah.
So when I do a sprint plan, so to speak, when I do my, sort of, the morning of or the night before, one of the things that the tool makes you do is go through and actually say how many hours per day you can commit to doing work.
Right.
And see, as a PM, where half of my day, as you can see, is meetings, this was a really great thing
from a
visibility standpoint.
What a great deal. You work 4 hours a day. Awesome.
I know, right? this is an awesome job. Because the other 4 hours, we just sit around.
Yeah.
No, but, when you look at how many hours a day you spend in meetings or how many hours a day you spend doing, chasing fire drills and so on and so forth.
Right.
This was a nice forcing function to see just what you can commit to doing actual work. And what, yeah. for me, this combined with the estimating exercise made me, personally, it made me realize that I was way over committing.
Yeah, which is totally easy to do because if you're like me, I like to say yes. You know, somebody comes along and is like, Howard comes over and says, hey, Ron, can you do this? Yes. You know,
sure.
Somebody else comes by, yes, yes, yes. You know, so before you know it, I've got like 50 million things to do. And I'm like, I can't possibly get these all done. And then you have to disappoint people, which I hate to do.
Well, and at the very least, right, knowing what you can commit, knowing what you've estimated, and then knowing what the priorities of those things are. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you go over to the task list, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, I have these ordered in most important to least important.
Right, right.
Right. And so if I have to start cutting, which you can see I've got the ability to do that, then I know where to start.
Yeah, and you're making an explicit decision to cut, and you could like send that person an email, say, hey, sorry, I have to postpone this, or I'm not going to get to it. I think, you know, part of this, which is good not just for this kind of thing, but in a project or whatever, I have learned that if you have bad news to give, it's best to give it as early as possible.
Yeah.
Like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to do this. And, you know, sometimes we have this tendency to be heroic, like, well, you know, if I work on Saturday and I work all day Saturday, maybe I could get that done. I see, see you try not to say anything, and then Saturday's like, no way, it's not happening. And then Monday, when it finally had to be done, you're like, bad news at the last minute. That's terrible.
And, you know, aside from the work-life balance thing, and I, you know, I enjoy spending time with my family and such on weekends. But the other thing is, when I'm doing work on the weekends, I kind of made this explicit decision a while back that if I'm doing work on the weekends, it needs to be one of two things. It needs to be learning something new, or it needs to be writing code, either sample or open source.
And of course, I think actually it's a great thing to not work on the weekends, right?
So back to the work-life balance.
Yeah. But it's also really important. Those two things are very important, you know, because you mentioned, so a lot of people who are, you know, writing code all day, every day, you know, they're like, yeah, writing code, big deal. But it's very easy as somebody who's a program manager, sometimes you can slip out of writing code, right? Because you don't always have to do it, and many of your other things kind of rise to the top. So it's very important to keep your hands in the code, and it's important for us and maybe for our customers to know that we do force ourselves to do that. Because I have found a lot of times, I don't know if I really like the design or something until I write some code against it, and then I go,
The API, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was one of the big things that Glenn's talked about, you know, when he came into the team is, you know, neither one of us have that super deep down to the metal, like I can tell you how WCF, you know, transitions messages in an asynchronous way between the channel model and the service model, and, you know, we'll get there the longer in the team. But one of the things that I think he and I hope myself have both brought in is, you know, having been coding in the community and, you know, just sort of out there in the field even, things like test-driven development and things like just general patterns of IOC, I mean, these sort of broader things might not be quite so obvious when you spend all day, every day, heads down on a specific thing.
Or like, you know, there's stuff that, there's things like jQuery, for example.
Right.
jQuery is on my list. I'm like, man, I got to learn that thing. I mean, I know a little bit, but I need to learn a lot more because, you know, somebody comes and says, hey, Ron, I'm using jQuery to do blah, blah, blah. You know, what's the right way to do that? And I go, I have no idea.
So,
you know?
So I mean, sort of, so the big idea there is, right, so as a PM, I think it's a big part of my job, at least, to always be sort of out there looking at what's happening outside of you know, our team and our company, right?
Right.
To make sure that we're supporting, you know, the best practices sort of as they're emerging, or, you know, putting those best practices into the product, right? You know, I think that's an important thing, and I want to make sure that from a time management perspective,
right,
that I'm able to still allocate time to do that.
So Scrum Pig, kind of fun tool.
Yep.
All right, cool. Thanks so much, Howard, for sharing that with us. And, of course, one of the great ways that you can stay up to date on all kinds of stuff is by watching At Fabric TV and our many other wonderful shows here on Channel 9. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks.